Hello, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Twilight, the new teen vampire movie. Be warned that we will be spoiling, as advertised in the title, so if you haven't seen the movie, you haven't read the book, and you're dying to know what happens in Twilight, but don't want us to tell you, then tune in later. I'm here with Julia Turner, Slate's deputy editor. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Dana.
So I'm actually going to pitch the plot summary over to you because you, unlike me, have you read all the Twilight books or only the first one?
No, there are four books and I've read only the first one. And I should admit here, I only read the first one because it was all I could stomach.
Mm-hmm.
The books are compelling, but terribly, terribly.
And written. You were interested just because it's a huge bestseller and you wanted to see what it was all about?
Yeah, I wanted to see what it was all about. And I'm generally interested in young adult fantasy success. I mean, I really liked the Philip Pullman books and I really liked the Harry Potter books. I tend to like and read those books. But I read this one and did not like it. So the plot of Twilight is that a girl named Bella Swan, who is sort of clumsy and has no particular characteristics, moves to her father's home in the small town of Forks, Washington, where she meets a clan of vampires, although they merely appear to be very handsome, rich high school students at first, and falls in love with one of them. And then they moon around for a while, loving each other.
Moon around for about 600 pages, it looks like, from the size
of
the book.
It's a very hefty book. So they admire each other and fall in love protractedly. And this love is somewhat allowable because Edward is a vampire who is a vegetarian and does not eat humans, only eats animals. And then there's another clan of vampires who are not so vegetarian, who pursue and hunt humans. Eventually, they recognize that Edward loves Bella the human. They decide to hunt her, and thus we are taken to the stirring climax of the book.
And the setup for the next book and the next movie, obviously, which is that, you know, this more ruthless clan of human-eating vampires is gonna move in and try to break up the Bella and Edward relationship by eating Bella. That would effectively end it. But then we should also mention that, I mean, the center of the movie is actually not this kind of crime plot about the vampires, the bad vampires going around killing people, but more this kind of very long Romeo and Juliet, like, sort of wrong side of the tracks love story where human falls in love with vampire and essentially they have to hold off from ever consummating their relationship because he might just eat her alive.
Yeah, I think the key phrase in both the movie and the book is, if I lost control for even one moment, I could break your neck. I don't know what I would do. I would consume you. And so they just sort of look at each other and think about each other and sort of stroke each other's arms tenderly for like long passages of the book.
Well,
and the
here's
movie.
Where we should talk about the difference between the book and the movie, because I found that the movie really divided very clearly into the first 30 or 40 minutes, which was all this kind of passive, you know, meaningful, angsty teen staring that was completely boring and unintentionally laughable. But that when the love story actually kicked in and the, you know, suspense plot about vampirism actually kicked in, that in its weird pulpy way, the movie became kind of great. And you were saying that this early teen staring part is essentially what the book is from beginning to end.
Yeah, I was interested to see this movie because I really, really didn't like the book, in part because I think the book is atrociously written. It's sort of like a bad Harlequin romance novel, except it doesn't get you hot and bothered because it's so badly written. And then also because I think it has just, it's Bella is a terrible role model for young girls. I think the gender politics of the book are completely messed up, which we can touch on later. But I was surprised to find that the movie is actually much better than the book because it cuts way down on all the passages where Bella and Edward just stare at each other and say inane things, even though there are still many, many scenes in the movie where they stare at each other.
I want you to read that passage from the book at this juncture because I think it captures certainly the mood of the book, apparently goes on and on for pages like this, but also that mood of the early part of the movie that is all about, you know, just two kids in biology class kind of staring at each other meaningfully.
Right.
But you should know before reading this passage that in both the book and the movie, the vampires have this particular quality that I've never seen in another vampire book or movie where when they stand in full sunlight, they have iridescent skin that glitters like diamonds.
Yeah, they basically they become brilliantine, sort of. So it begins, Edward in the sunlight was shocking. I couldn't get used to it, although I'd been staring at him all afternoon. His skin, white despite the faint flush from yesterday's hunting trip, literally sparkled like thousands of tiny diamonds were embedded in the surface. He lay perfectly still in the grass, his shirt open over his sculpted, incandescent chest, his scintillating arms bare. His glistening, pale lavender lids were shut, though, of course, he didn't sleep. And then she goes on to say, I reached out one finger and stroked the back of his shimmering hand, where it lay within my reach. I marveled again at the perfect texture, satin smooth, cool as stone. When I looked up again, his eyes were open, watching me. Butterscotch today, lighter, warmer after hunting. His quick smile turned up the corners of his flawless lips. And that note on butterscotch is that one of his other vampire qualities is that when he's hungry for blood, his eyes are dark black. But once he's sated with a hunting trip to go eat some friendly young Bambi does, they turn like golden cat color.
He has a strange, in the description that you read, he has this sort of doll-like quality. You can see why this is a huge success with 12, 13-year-old. I don't know what the age is exactly that this appeals to, but it seems like it's just one step beyond playing with dolls, and it's sort of some step in between that and some kind of erotic reverie about boys.
I wonder if that's part of the appeal for these young girls. I mean,
it's so static and strange.
It's not like a real human man in any way. And it was funny. I mean, we were in this screening last night that had some young girls in it, and the lights went down, and before even anything had appeared on the screen, there was just shrieking in the theater. Edward! I love you, Edward Cullen! Woo! So in some ways, maybe the appeal to these young girls is that it is this sort of sexless fantasy of romance. It's a weird fantasy, though, because they just have such boring conversations. I had trouble getting into it.
Well, but I have to say that, I mean, as a sexy story, it goes nowhere. It's almost more like a story about abstinence, right? Because they can't consummate anything. They even only kiss one time in the movie. But as a love story, I don't know. I have a little bit of a weakness for, you know, this kind of female pathology love story. And I actually found that the part where they were supposedly falling in love, and there were these sort of great metaphors for falling in love. For example, when he takes her, not exactly flying because he can't fly, but he takes her on this crazy sort of treetop chase through these very high pine trees. And these kind of lyrical passages that showed them falling in love when we didn't have to actually see them acting and looking at each other were kind of moving. We should mention that the director is Catherine Hardwicke, who made, well, 13 is the movie she's most associated with. I think it's her only other film besides this.
No. She also made The Nativity Story,
She made The Story About Mary, which is, I thought, was a complete failure, but I forgot that was a Hardwicke movie.
And she also did,
Oh, Lords of Dogtown, that's right.
I think that whoever chose her to direct this movie is a genius, because to my mind, she broadens the appeal of it. I mean, it's a really beautiful production. The sense of color and place and the production design is beautiful. It really takes full advantage of the kind of gloomy, overcast, it's like Pacific Northwest Gothic, and it's just beautiful, beautiful shots of land with that rich color that you get when the sky is overcast. I just thought it was amazing to look at, first of all. And then also, Catherine Hardwicke is just so smart about the weird politics and obsessions of teenage girls, or at least good at portraying them with a lot of detail.
Yeah, I think she understands adolescence. And the writer, Melissa Rosenberg, who previously wrote for The OC and Party of Five, and also, I guess, wrote the step dance movie Step Up, which you liked, right?
Oh, yes, that's one of my preferred in the dance movie pantheon.
So I think there's something that the two of them together get. For one thing, just this movie being written and directed by women is interesting because it clearly is trying to appeal to the sort of like younger Sex in the City demographic, to this sort of like not necessarily healthy fantasies of a big demographic of girls. But there's something about the mood of this movie. You're right. The look of it, the production design, that even with all the risible acting, and we should say that I think that the boy who was so carefully chosen, Rob Pattinson, to play, you know, this ultra desirable teen vampire is a terrible actor.
He really is. I mean, it's sort of like he just stares wide-eyed and deer in the headlights into the distance.
Maybe it's not even so much that he's a terrible actor. Poor boy. He was just not given anything to do except stand around being iridescent and meaningful.
He has some lines in it that are kind of wisecracky responses to Bella. Her one quality is that she's a sardonic teenager who doesn't buy into the whole prom and giggling teenage girlhood. She's a little too cool for school, which I think is perhaps part of her appeal as a character. But the character, Edward, does have some riposts to her wisecracks that I didn't think he delivered particularly well. I think someone could have done more with it. But it's also just an impossible task. I wrote a piece when that Troy movie came out a couple years ago about the impossibility of finding someone to play Helen of Troy, because when the whole point of the character is that they just typify beauty, that they are beauty itself personified, any specific instance of it is going to be less than whatever you imagine when you read the text and project your own particular ideas about beauty onto it. So anybody would be a disappointment in some ways. I mean, I guess he's more of a disappointment from an acting perspective than he looked fine, I guess.
He seemed to be a big hit with the teen girls in the theater anyway.
Yeah, it seemed like he was working for them there. But I think, I mean, the thing that's interesting about the book and that's complicated about its gender politics is, on the one hand, it's very okay with the idea of teenage girls having sexual desire and being all about ogling boys and men, which is, you know, not a classic thing to encourage young girls to do. on the other hand, Bella is a complete victim. She can't do anything except be rescued all the time. All she wants once she discovers how much she loves Edward is to be made a vampire so that she can give up her normal life and just live with him forever in vampire love. You know, she basically wants to die to be with him, and she keeps imploring him to kill her, to suck her blood, to turn her into a vampire, and he refuses. He wants her to just have a nice normal life and grow old, and they can live in some house together where he still looks like a pale, icy 17-year-old, and she grows into her dotage. And so they have these sort of conflicting fantasies about their future, which I guess probably set up the tensions for the rest of the series. But she's just, I don't know. I mean, is this a set of books that you think you'd want your daughter to read based on what you saw last
night?
No,
I have to say, it sounds like the books especially, and the movie to some extent too, are sort of horrible moral messages for young girls. But at the same time, I mean, isn't there something kind of compelling about getting to have a politically incorrect fantasy? You know, God knows that men, the large demographics of men, get to have very politically incorrect fantasies all the time. And I don't know, I guess once your girl was old enough, 16, 17 years old, that, you know, they're probably reading these books anyway, I don't think there would be anything wrong with showing them this movie.
No, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just when you compare Bella to Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, yeah, she's not spunky. She is not a spunky character at all.
No, all she ever does is say, oh, I can't do that. Oh, I wouldn't be good at that. She is smart. They make a point of showing that she's just as good at science as Edward Cullen, who's had to take science for the past 80 years since he's been a vampire, as he's perpetually pretended to go to high school. So she's not ditzy or dumb or anything, but she just has no desire other than to be with this dude.
So why is it then that along with me, we both sort of walked out of this movie saying, wow, it actually, you thought that it improved on the book. And I don't know, I thought that there was actually something sort of achingly, excruciatingly, and, you know, extremely in a silly way, but just very romantic and beautiful about it.
I just think it's beautiful. I think that's the right word. I think the production design, the sense of landscape, and the way that Hardwick conveys the speed of the vampires, these are very fast vampires who can sprint and run around, was impressive. I mean, I walked out of the movie with that feeling that I had at the end of The Matrix, where I sort of felt my physicality in the world slightly differently. You know, where you after seeing The Matrix, you were so used to the things coming at you at 7,000 miles an hour that I remember trying to drive home on an interstate afterwards and, like, repeatedly having to force myself not to break the speed limit because I just expected things to come flying at me that fast. And I had a similar, I don't know, broody gothic hangover when I walked out of the theater, where I went down into the subway station and men were bustling past me in their
and
coats.
And you glared iridescently at them?
I was thinking, oh, these, like, secret vampire men in the bowels of New York. You know, it was you know, like a tone poem or a mood piece. Like, it got the feel of this broody, dark world in a really neat,
I'm with you there,
way.
But unlike you, I think I was actually somewhat moved by the love story too, and maybe that's just because, you know, I have a bigger masochistic streak or something, but I feel like I spent my whole 20s pining after men who were far worse for me than any vampire could ever be.
I don't know. I maybe I would have been freer to enjoy the love story in the movie if I hadn't read the love story in the book, which is just so dopey. But I never liked the love at first sight love stories. I don't like Romeo and Juliet either, and I would argue that I don't actually think Shakespeare thinks Romeo and Juliet are a great pair of romantic heroes either. I think he's sort of making fun of them too a little bit in that play. I don't know. I never go for those stories.
Get to know each other, kids. Come on.
Have a couple conversations.
Have a soda at the mall before you kill
yourself.
All they
talk about is what it's like to be a vampire. First, he spends a lot of time figuring out that he is a vampire and doing, like, Google research. Then they talk about what it's like to be a vampire. Then they talk about whether or not she should ever be a vampire. They have, like, no. Then there's a couple places when they learn that they can't kiss and make out like normal teenagers, where they talk in her bed late into the night. But they do that in a montage with music over it, so they don't actually have to invent any real interesting conversation for them to have, because they have nothing to talk about besides,
I guess,
his vampirism.
Was the case with the movie 13, which had a way better performance from Evan Rachel Wood than anyone in this movie gives, I think. But it had in some ways a similar story in that it was about the early teenage years and all the pathological, crazy, but yet strangely pleasurable and compelling things that they make people do. And I feel like Catherine Hardwick just gets that world really, really well. And
she does,
speaks
but
that
you're
language.
Reminding me that that movie was, to my mind, the dark pull in that movie was much more powerful. Sort of the Evan Rachel Wood character is sort of a halfway innocent girl with a wild streak who befriends, am I remembering this right, who befriends sort of a wild child girl who has her huffing glue and, like, cutting and running around. I don't have the details quite right, but basically leads her into wild behavior, wild promiscuous drug abusing behavior. And that the magnetism of that bad friend character, to me, was much more powerful and well-drawn than the magnetism of the brooding Edward Cullen.
I absolutely agree. And this is sort of a repackaging, a much more mass-market repackaging of some of the same ideas. So it's, you know, it's not near as well done, and it's not near as smart. But I think it has that same appeal to a completely different kind of audience.
Here's my question for you. Do you think this movie is going to be big just with Twilight fans, or do you think it will cross over into the general...
That's a good question. Obvious. My question would be more, will boys like it and will boys go and see it, and can it possibly succeed if they don't? You know, maybe that's why I thought of Sex and the City as a kind of marketing comparison. But it converted me to want to see the next Twilight movie. I'll say that. I'm not going to go and read, you know, the 600-page books.
I advise against.
But something about, even though I was rolling my eyes throughout at various moments, I have to say that when those little giveaways started to be planted at the end that something was going to be revealed in the next movie, I thought, gee, I really want to see how that turns out.
Totally. Especially if Hardwick directs it, if they turn it over to somebody else.
Oh, yeah. They have to leave it in her hands. But yeah. I have a feeling she will, because if this is even a modest hit, it just seems like it's really her. She's very at home in this milieu. Well, Julia, thanks so much for seeing the movie and bringing your expertise on the book.
I'm ashamed to have such expertise, but happy to share it.
And thank you for joining me on this Slate spoiler special. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.